The third case is oral argument calendar is case number A19-1929, Bachmeier versus Bachmeier. Today's date is July 8th, 2020, and Ms. Myers is counsel for appellant. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Misty Myers and I represent appellant father Kyle Bachmeier. And I would also like to reserve time for rebuttal this afternoon.
Yes, yes, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal automatically in addition to an initial allotment of 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. To begin, I believe it is important to point out three pertinent facts from this case. From August 2018 to May 2019, appellant enjoyed 2 overnights per week with his minor child. From May 2019, at the conclusion of the trial, until October 2019, appellant enjoyed 1 overnight per week, and this was due solely to the availability of a supervised exchange center. So 1 overnight was taken away strictly because of scheduling with a supervised exchange center. The judgment and decree was entered in October 2019, and that the district court then gratuitously took away the remaining overnight from the child with his father. This was an abuse of discretion and did not further the purported goal of protecting the child from the conflict of the exchanges, which the district court believed to be an issue. Interestingly enough, the number of exchanges that appellant and respondent had when appellant enjoyed his 2 overnights was 4. Currently, with 0 overnights, they still have 4 exchanges. Now, the removal of the overnight parenting time was punitive, unfair, and arbitrary, and the findings are not supported by the facts that were presented at trial. And what we're asking the Court of Appeals for today is to remand this case back to district court for findings that are consistent with at least 25% parenting time, as that statutory presumption has not been rebutted. Minnesota Statute 518.175, Subdivision 1A, provides that parenting time shall be granted as such that will enable a parent and child to maintain a relationship that is in the best interests of the child. Currently, the minor child that we're talking about today only has 1.5 days a month with his father, appellant Mr. Bachmeier. That's 9 hours a week. That is not enough time for him to bond with his dad. The custody and parenting time evaluation report and the custody evaluator's testimony support that appellant father was appropriate with his son and that they enjoyed their time together. Testimony of both parents and the custody evaluator was such that the minor child is a happy, well-adjusted child. There were no issues there. Now, the district court arbitrarily determined that appellant father's parenting time should be restricted. He is now at 0%. He has no overnights with his toddler. 518.175, subdivision 1B, requires restriction of parenting time if the court can find that parenting time is likely to endanger a child's physical or emotional health. We simply do not have that here. The district court made blanket statements that harm is likely, but that is not supported by the testimony or the exhibits. The custody and parenting time evaluation makes a statement that maximizing parenting time could be detrimental, but there was no testimony nor indication in the reports that it was likely that the minor child was experiencing any of this. There was a tremendous amount of emphasis placed on sleep hygiene and the fact that the minor child was tired upon arrival back to mother's home from appellants after appellant's parenting time. But beyond that, there is no indication that that either the exchanges nor the overnight parenting time with appellant father rises to the level of endangerment, specifically the significant degree of danger that is required by Ross v. Ross. Now, respondent's brief discusses three cases, Grain v. Grain, Sharp v. Bilbo, and Newstrand v. Ahrens. And she indicates that harm doesn't have to be present. It just has to be likely. And I agree with that. However, those three cases are distinguishable from the case that's before you today. Because in those cases, there are findings beyond just potential emotional harm.
In Grain v. Grain, Ms. Myers, why isn't it that you'd mentioned that you argue that there's nothing in the record to support a likelihood of endangerment to the child, but there seems to be evidence in the record that father did not have any knowledge of the child's routine, including his sleep routine. And I mean, I think we've got a lot of data out there. There's a lot of information on the importance of sleep, particularly for children as they're growing up, and the need for a significant amount of sleep for children and the need for a routine for children. But father didn't seem to know that. There are plenty of studies out there showing that children that don't get enough sleep don't do well in school. They tend to have behavioral issues. There's a lot of dangers. There's just a report that just came out the other day. I saw that not getting the proper amount of sleep can actually lead to early death. So why isn't that even by itself enough to show likelihood of endangerment to a child by not letting them get the proper amount of sleep that they are supposed to get?
Thank you, Your Honor. The record does not reflect that he was not getting the proper amount of sleep. It was consistency between homes, but there was also testimony regarding the fact that appellant father during his time with the child was taking the child to child parenting courses at night. He was only having the child two overnights a week at that point, and these classes were only at certain times, and he did not have control over the times of those classes, and so he was getting home later. And so that in and of itself, Your Honor, it still does not rise to the level of endangerment. The testimony was not such that the child was sleep deprived, if you will. It was that there was not consistent bedtimes. And there were a variety of things that were impacting that, such as the ECFE classes that were being taken, that everyone agreed that those were necessary and that those were beneficial to Mr. Bachmeier. The cases that do talk about the level of endangerment that is necessary to require a restriction of parenting time, it's not just the potential emotional harm that these cases are talking about. Grain v. Grain, for instance, there are multiple things that case incorporates. The potential for emotional harm is certainly in there, but it's also the interference with parenting time. So they're not relying solely on the potential or the likelihood of emotional health. Sharp v. Bilbo, there was severe mental health concerns for the parent. There was a personality disorder, and that parent was subjecting the child to unnecessary sexual abuse exams. Newstrand v. Ahrens, again, we're talking about a denial of access to a parent and blatant efforts to paint the parent in a negative light, as well as concerns about mental health and specific opposition to mental health services. So it's more than just one thing that's precipitating this endangerment. Whereas in this case, the court really focused on a very generalized piece, whereas, again, in Wallen v. Wallen, we need particularized findings. and it does not rise to that significant degree of danger that we need to see pursuant to Ross v. Ross. And then we also have the 25% parenting time presumption that was not addressed by the court. And that was not rebutted. It was not addressed by the court, and it wasn't rebutted. And so Mr. Bachmeier certainly has the ability to parent. He exercised 28% parenting time from August to May, and that was reduced only because of the scheduling issues of FamilyWise, the supervised exchange center. And as such, he should be permitted to continue to exercise at least that 25% parenting time. It was brought to the court's attention throughout the proceedings that Mr. Bachmeier was requesting. He was initially requesting 50-50 parenting time. It was brought up in pretrial pleadings. It was brought up by response in her affidavit and memorandum of law, in case law. And then it was further in testimony brought up when the potential for restricted parenting time was being addressed. The court was on notice that Mr. Bachmeier was requesting more than 25% parenting time, but the court did not address it in its findings. And so we are asking that this be remanded back to the district court for findings consistent with that. The findings that the court presented are deficient. They do not support the 0% parenting time that was awarded to Mr. Bachmeier. They do not allow for that parent-child bond to be maintained. Further, he does have a tight-knit family, and those bonds cannot be maintained with 9 hours of parenting time. We're talking toddler and his father, and that time you can't get back. And there's not enough here. It does not rise to the level that is required for this kind of restriction of parenting time.
Ms. Myers, have you concluded your argument? Ms. Myers? Can you hear me?
I can.
Can you hear me okay?
And the clock isn't moving, and so I'm wondering how much time I have.
Oh, I see it moving now with 2 minutes and 10 seconds.
Okay.
I wonder if your screen is frozen, but to me, you're still moving and talking, and I can hear you. So please proceed if you have more to say.
Okay. I will conclude my argument, Your Honor.
Does either Judge Reyes or Judge Frisch have any questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Myers. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Uthy, on behalf of the respondent. I think you're still muted, Ms. Uthy. If you could please unmute your mic.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. So, whole new world with COVID for all of us.
Right.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, to all of you. I'll start first by addressing the 25% issue. 25%, according to Hagen v. Shermers, which is a 2010 case, if a appellant wanted that, they should have raised it, they should have argued it, otherwise they are foreclosed from bringing it. It was not raised, it was not argued. We raised it by discussing it in a memorandum with the lower court, giving the court reasons why we felt less than 25% was appropriate. we raised that in a memorandum that went unresponded to at the district court level. Then we went forward to trial. I would like to go back to the original facts just briefly. Both parties, when this trial commenced, were asking for sole legal and sole physical custody. By the end of trial, after which we'd heard much from testimony and the experts and the parties themselves, the appellant asked for joint physical and legal custody and changed his position. That being said, the 25% was never mentioned by appellant in any arguments other than changing his position and saying, I want joint after going to solo. It was not, there is no record of it at the lower court. So it is our position that it is foreclosed. If the court finds that it was raised because it was raised through our client, through the mom, then we get...
Ms. Yuthi? Yes. Yuthi, if I could stop you there before you go on, and I would like to hear your alternative argument, but how should a party in his position raise it? Must they raise it? I mean, if he was asking for, I think, 50% parenting time, I mean, is it necessary for him to make basically an alternative argument that's in the nature of, judge, if you give me less than 50, I just want to make sure you don't go below 25. I mean, that's kind of an awkward argument to make. Is a party such as the father in this case really in a position where they must make that argument in order to get the benefit of that statutory provision? Or is there another way, or I guess to return to my question, is there some other way that he could have and should have raised it? I mean, what's the proper way for him and the proper time for him to preserve that issue?
I believe it's proper to have at the time. Probably the best in this particular case, best time would have been to respond to our memorandum saying, no, less than 25 is not appropriate, and here is why, and give us the rational basis, or give the court rather the rational basis for doing that. It went unresponded to. And when it.
And you're referring to the post trial memorandum?
There was a and that is mentioned in our brief.
And were the briefs staggered, sequential, and was there an opportunity to do either a responsive brief or a reply brief?
I believe so, because it was in response to the temporary schedules we were arguing at that point in time, if I'm remembering correctly, on that. And it is mentioned in our brief. I can find that for you, but the timeline on it when we had raised it.
Okay, I think you've answered. Thank you. So you may proceed with your alternative argument if you wish.
Certainly, but that is an interesting argument. How does one raise it? Then moving forward, even if it had been raised, or assuming that the court feels it was raised, simply because of his request for asking for 50-50 custody, the court, in making its determination on the parenting time, went through a complete analysis of why it did so. The fact that it did not make a specific finding on the 25% issue, the court didn't say, I'm doing less than 25 and here's why. If you look at the rest of the best interest factors and why the court made the final decision that it did, there's clear enough rationale there as to why she restricted the parenting time. And the fact that the court gave an out for father at the end of the day to increase that parenting time, the court went through the analysis. So the fact that it failed to specifically talk about it is simply harmless error. I have no doubt if this were remanded back for the trial court to make a specified determination or finding on that, that the court would, and has a completely rational basis to do so, and plenty of facts in the record that are supported. So that is our position. It wasn't raised properly. Even if it was deemed raised properly, it should be considered harmless error, and it's not an abuse of discretion. Therefore, it's a non-issue. And that is, brings me to the next point. A very solid case that is on point for our case is the Thornton v. Vasquez. And that was an appellate court decision that involved somewhat similar facts, because we had two, in that case, the court had the appellant, the mom and the dad, both with allegations of various types of domestic abuse. It talked about, in the Thornton v. Vasquez, the Court of Appeals decision that was, I believe, drafted by Your Honor, Judge Johnson. And in that case, the trial court had awarded joint physical custody, which is different than here, but on the domestic abuse piece and the rebuttable presumption, it's very clear that if there is domestic abuse, period, and it is goes unrebutted, it doesn't matter who is, which party, there is no specific party that has that burden, is what I'm trying to say. The Supreme Court, that case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said it's not any specific person's burden. It wouldn't have been either the dad's burden or mom's burden in this case. The court clearly found there was domestic abuse. Then in this
case, I recall, Ms. Uthi, am I correct in remembering that in this case, the district court made a finding that father did not rebut the presumption?
Yes. She specifically did, in this case, found that father had not rebutted the presumption, since he is the party that requested joint legal and physical at the end of the trial.
Because, so I thought you said just a minute ago that neither party has the burden of rebutting the presumption. I mean, so was it proper for the district court to essentially put that burden on him, or to acknowledge that he had not rebutted it? Was that proper?
Yes, and I apologize. I was being very unclear there. There is a burden on the party who is wanting joint custody. That is where the burden, if the court finds, if there is domestic abuse, that, okay, let me back up. For the best interest standard, there is somewhat of a presumption that there should be joint, unless there's domestic abuse. The court finds domestic abuse, and that was clearly found in this case. The coercive control, the domestic abuse, all of those things were pointed more at father in this case, although there were some allegations that mom had also, and she admitted to some acts of domestic abuse as well. So similar to the Vasquez case, the Thornton v. Vasquez, we have both parties making allegations of some domestic abuse, right? So in this case, though, we only have one party that was requesting joint custody. So we have the best interest standard, and we have the presumption that it should not be joint because of a domestic abuse. Then we have a party with the statutory presumption of 1B saying, well, it should be joint because I'm asking for it. Then that puts the burden back on them to try to disprove that domestic abuse and try to prove that the parties, yes, we can indeed get along in spite of this abuse, and try to overturn that presumption. So the trial court properly went through that analysis and properly found that father had not overcome that presumption. He had not, in fact, rebutted that. In fact, she goes into very specific details of how he didn't, in spite of the fact that there were the numerous witnesses, including the custody evaluator, the psychological evaluator, and the assessments. Everyone said father had these severe control issues and that he was undermining the relationship with mom. It made it impossible for the two of them to deal with one another and co-parent in a successful manner. And he did nothing to help that during the trial, presented no evidence, and the judge made a finding on that. A very specified findings that he failed to do that and went ahead and awarded the sole legal and sole physical to the mother in this case. And it's, I guess that was Roman numeral 7 is where she says husband has failed to rebut the presumption. So the burden was properly on him, which was a little different than the Vasquez case in that sense, because in that sense it was trying to determine did whether the aggressor, whoever was deemed the aggressor, whether the burden was on them. So I believe that was successfully covered by the trial court in this case as well. There was a very detailed analysis in the record and in the judgment and decree that we have here from the trial court explaining exactly why this was never going to work as a joint custodial situation. As far as I'd like to go back and cover real briefly in my last few minutes here, unless we have other questions. The child in this case was only a year of age when this began. And the court, with very minimal information, did allow father to have some overnights. That was due to some factual reasons, part of which some of the behaviors that progressed were not shown at the time of that initial temporary order. Number one. Number two, he was living and residing with his parents, so there was that extra level of care and availability to, you know, it's almost supervised, if you will, that factually he was living with his parents. Those were temporary orders. The amendment was a second temporary order that happened during the time that after the trial and the time that the final decision came out, the final decree. So I was reading appellant's brief as if there was some sort of final decree that was then modified by the judge as a reduction. She never reduced. It's just as she had more information, she reduced. But we didn't ever have a final order until the last one, where she did give him significantly less than he had had before. But that is not a reduction or a modification, because those two prior orders were temporary and simply that, temporary orders. So I would remind the court that the district court had broad discretion. I believe that this case should be upheld because there were credibility determinations, clear findings of fact, full basis on the record. She correctly applied the law, and this case should be upheld because there was no error of law. Nothing was clearly erroneous. Thank you.
Johnson, you're muted.
I apologize. Thank you, Ms. Uthe. And Ms. Myers, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I do want to briefly discuss the 25% presumption and how it is appropriately raised in district court. As Ms. Uthe indicated, it was actually a respondent who raised it in her memorandum. However, the interesting piece, if we can look at statutory construction, as Ms. Uthe was discussing the rebuttable presumption of joint legal custody, within that statutory framework, the statute is clear that the court shall use a rebuttable presumption that upon request of either or both parties. So to me, that's an explicit request, whereas that language is completely absent in the 25% rebuttable presumption. And so to be appropriately raised, the district court just needs to be aware that it exists. And as the court indicates in the unpublished opinion Post v. Post, I think that the courts generally are aware that the 25% presumption is there. And when a party requests a specific amount of parenting time that is over and above 25%, and they're not just asking for something like reasonable and liberal parenting time, that should trigger that 25% rebuttable presumption. The statute is clear that a parent is entitled to receive a minimum 25%. It does not say upon request. It does not say that it has to be explicitly brought to the court's attention. The case law says appropriately raised. Well, what does that mean? It means that they have to be made aware. The court was aware. The court was aware via the memorandum by respondent.
But counsel, shouldn't that really be raised by the party that is interested, that wants to advocate on that issue?
Well, and I believe that the presumption, again, I think that the 25% was raised in that Mr. Bachmeier, the appellant, was requesting more than 25%. And that is the intent of the legislature. From the pleadings throughout the proceedings, that was appellant's request. He was requesting a specific amount of parenting time that was over and above the statutory minimum. He had appropriately raised that issue to the district court. He had requested to not have his parenting time reduced. He had requested and argued for it not to be restricted below the 25%. Respondent had requested that his parenting time be restricted to below that 25%. And appellant had argued against it. I believe that that amounts to being appropriately raised to the district court.
Counsel, what about Ms. Uthi's argument that even though the district court did not expressly address the 25% rebuttable presumption, the statute itself does provide that the presumption only applies, quote, in the absence of other evidence. And the district court's order is full of at least what the district court considers to be that other evidence that would justify a restriction on parenting time. So isn't the issue about whether the 25% presumption was raised or not raised or addressed specifically by the court just a harmless error?
And I'll go back to my initial argument. The restriction and the 25% presumption in this case seemingly go hand in hand. And the findings do not support a restriction. The findings do not rise to the level, and the testimony and the exhibits do not support the findings that rise to the level of endangerment that would be necessary to restrict a parent to have 0% parenting time. The district court had a big concern with exchanges. Well, that concern was remedied by using the supervised exchange center, and that occurred at the conclusion of the trial. That occurred before the findings came out. And the number of exchanges, that was something that the district court brought up. They were concerned that that the number of exchanges would create issues, but again, the number of exchanges hasn't changed. What changed was the mechanism for the exchanges. And so that solved that problem. It's not the overnights, it was the exchanges. And so then we're left with the consistency in parenting. And appellant, as he had testified to, and these things came after the custody evaluation. The custody evaluation was done very early on. It began in October of 2018. The trial was in May 2019. And appellant had then began working with a parenting coach, was engaged in individual counseling, was attending the ECFE classes, and was trying to garner those parenting skills because the child was very young, and both parties had testified to the mother being the primary caretaker up until that point. But he was learning those skills and trying to develop those skills as a parent as well. And so presumably that also doesn't rise to the level of endangerment. And we're now seeing 0% parenting time for not having the same bedtime as respondent.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Your time has expired. So the case is submitted. Thank you very much for your arguments. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.
The court is now in recess.